Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. The 2012 presidential race has officially begun. Democrats and Republicans continue to negotiate the federal budget as they try to avoid a shutdown. Ohio will become a battleground state even before 2012 as union supporters and opponents promise to battle it out over public employee collective bargaining rights. And it looks like Sherrod Brown has an opponent. To size this all up and help us cut through the spin, we are joined by Ken Rudin, senior political editor for NPR and host of the blog The Political Junkie. Ken, welcome to All Sides.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning. Before we get to the election politics, let's get to the budget politics. House Speaker John Boehner, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, and President Obama meeting today at the White House to try to reach a budget compromise. Here's the Speaker of the House.
I've never believed that shutting the government down was the goal. The goal here is to cut spending because cutting spending reduces uncertainty. It'll help our economy.
Ken Rudin, what are the chances of a government shutdown by the end of the week? Do you think they'll reach a compromise?
Well, yes, but who knows? And the reason we say who knows is because Boehner, and we hear Boehner talking about not wanting a shutdown, and he doesn't want a shutdown because we saw what happened the last time it was a government shutdown, who got the blame, and that was mostly Newt Gingrich and the majority Republicans. But again, aside from the blame game, he has to wrestle with its competing factions in his own party, the folks who do want to get something done, because you can't just keep doing a week-to-week-to-week budget process. That's just insane. And you have the Tea Party folks who really don't owe their allegiance to anybody except the people who elected them in 2010, who said that, you know, politics as usual is not working. And we, you know, $61 billion is just the minimum we need to you know, sign on to this agreement.
So he's dealing with three sides: mainstream, quote, mainstream Republicans, the Tea Party Republicans, and the Democrats.
That's exactly right. And, you know, as he says, he only controls one half of one third of the government. That's true. I mean, he controls the Republicans control the House, but the Democrats control the Senate, and the Democrats control the White House. And, of course, nobody knows who controls the judiciary here. But the point is that a lot of people are looking to Boehner as the guy who's going to guide this, whether it's success or failure. And he said that's putting too much on his shoulders. But as we saw after 1994, when the Republicans decided to just make, you know, big strides, and some people said they were overreaching, John Boehner, who was around back then, is very aware of what happened to the Republican perception, the Republican brand in 95 and 96, and he doesn't want to see it repeated in 2011 and 2012.
We're speaking with Ken Rudin, NPR's political junkie, here on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. The House GOP is looking for a $61 billion cut. The Democrats are willing to give up $33 billion. Might they just split the difference?
Well, yes, and that's the way you usually do that when you compromise, and that's exactly what the Tea Party doesn't like. I mean, they say, sure, you know, Democrats want no cuts, Republicans want $61 billion in cuts, so therefore let's cut it down the middle. And he said, but that's not really compromising. It's really just selling out your principles. And that's really the core difference, what Obama and the Senate Democrats and the House Republicans are dealing with, because Democrats are more willing to compromise in some way because they have been going along with spending cuts in all these incremental temporary resolutions to continue the government, you know, to continue government operations, whereas Republicans say, look, many Tea Party Republicans say, I'd rather go down and have this budget shut down than compromise and sell out the principles that I worked so hard when I got elected in 2010.
Compare the mood of the country in 1994 compared to now. Might the public be more willing to accept a government shutdown and not place the blame on the Republicans because of fear of growing deficits?
Well, polls do show that, you know, if a shutdown does come, and who gets blamed, I think it was something like 39% blame the Republicans, 36% may blame Obama, the White House, and the Democrats. And so, you know, neither side gets the most of the blame, unlike what happened in 95 and 96 when the Republicans took the heat. But you know something? We saw in 2010 when a lot of voters said, you know, budgets are getting out of hand, spending is getting out of hand, we've got to stop this. And then you see very aggressive Republican governors in response, like Scott Walker in Wisconsin, like John Kasich in Ohio, like Mitch Daniels in Indiana, do these, you know, pretty drastic stuff. And the question is whether the voters who wanted this or say they wanted all these cut back in spending and curbs on the unions and all that stuff in 2010, whether once reality sets in, whether they're still happy with that kind of decision.
We're speaking with Ken Rudin, NPR's political editor and host of the blog The Political Junkie here on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. 292-8513. If you have a question for Ken, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Ken, the Republicans also want to eliminate funding for Planned Parenthood, NPR, other things. How do those things get worked out in this budget compromise?
Well, you know, it's just remarkable. I mean, I don't want to editorialize here, but with all the spending that's so, you know, overwhelming, and we're talking about huge amounts being spent on Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security and things like that, for the House Republicans to have a special meeting the other day, an emergency meeting, because the $2 million that NPR is getting from the federal government or whatever it is just so, you know, egregious. It just shows you know, it gets into ideological battles here and less so much about budget battles. But look, everything should get cut. Everything has to get cut. So to say that NPR shouldn't get cut, Planned Parenthood shouldn't get cut, is really missing the point. The point is there is a tremendous deficit, not only in the federal government, but with state governments as well. And you just can't keep spending as usual. The question is whether it's everything is in proportion or whether it's an ideological crusade. And that's what the compromise is partly about as well.
Even if they do reach a compromise on the budget and they avoid the shutdown for a permanent basis, not just a one-week continuing resolution, there's another battle coming up on the debt ceiling. We're expected to hit the debt ceiling, which supposedly caps the amount of money the U.S. government can borrow, by mid-May was the latest projection I saw. So there's another battle looming there.
Right, and not only that's true, and there are a lot of Republicans who say I'm not going to vote to increase the debt ceiling unless there are corresponding cuts that the Democrats agree to. Now, also you have Paul Ryan, the chairman of the House Budget Committee, who offered this plan today, basically would cut $4 trillion from the federal budget over the next 10 years. And now we're talking about entitlement reform.
That's Medicare money, yep.
Exactly. And this is the third rail of politics that everybody's afraid to touch. You know, we keep talking about that. We're so tired of our politicians being afraid to, you know, make the real tough choices. And if you listen, you know, if you heard that debt commission report by Alan Simpson and Erskine Bowles a few months ago about what should be cut, well, President Obama didn't embrace that at all. The Democrats were very silent about it for the most part because they were afraid of the political consequences. And here we have Paul Ryan. Now, this is either very brave or very suicidal because politically, you know, you see the headlines that the Republicans want to cut Medicare. They want to cut $4 trillion out of this stuff. Is that what Americans, you know, is that what people voted for in 2010? They will look. It's one thing to say, yes, it's getting out of hand. The spending is getting out of hand. We've got to cut programs. And as many voters agreed to that in 2010. But when you see headlines that, you know, little granny is going to get thrown in the street or put into it, you know, whatever, a good part of it is politics. And in Washington, we always say that perception is reality. And whether Paul Ryan is doing a gutsy thing that is long overdue or committing suicide for his party, you know, that's the question that needs to be answered.
Here are the details on Paul Ryan's plan. It would slice $5 trillion from projected federal spending in the coming decades. So it wouldn't be a cut. It would be a reduction of what we expect to spend. It would shift some costs to the beneficiaries and to the states. For Medicaid, it would basically become a block grant program. States would be given a chunk of money that they could use for health care for the poor. Medicare money would go to the recipients, who would then buy insurance from private companies. Right now, Medicare money goes directly to the providers, the health care providers, the hospitals and the doctors. And the Medicare plan would not affect current recipients of Medicare.
Right, 55 and over.
55
right.
and over. So if you're retiring in the next, you know, 5 or 10 years, you're 5 years you're okay. 10 years, if this goes through, you might be affected. So it's basically privatizing, in some degree, privatizing Medicare.
It is, and again, whether the Scott Walker, John Kasich plans were really about reducing the deficit or punishing unions, a lot of people will ask whether this is really a way to get our budget in order, or is it a way to just, reverse the great society of Lyndon Johnson, and nobody seems to know that. And actually, if you cut the $4 to $5 trillion over 10 years, basically we're only back to where we were in 2008. It's not that we're going back to the 1930s or the Harding Coolidge administration, but it is just, you know, but when you see those headlines, it just seems drastic. And again, the name of the game is getting reelected, and whether it hurts, if it hurts the Republican Party, could be a very temporary, if not a Pyrrhic victory.
Let's go to the phones. Chris has a question about the budget. Go ahead, Chris. You're on the air with Ken Rudin, the NPR political junkie on 89.7 NPR News.
Yes, I'm wondering why either both the budget negotiators and our current guests haven't spoke about the defense budget. It is currently 23% of the budget we spend. The United States spends more than the next 17 nations combined on defense. We have 170 bases overseas, and which that's a different topic. But why aren't we talking about defense? We could easily cut by 50% and maintain our safety.
Well, you know, I guess again, politically, if we're in the middle of two wars, I mean, albeit trying to close down the war in Iraq, but there's no sign of any closure of the war in Afghanistan. We're bombing Libya, and who knows how far that'll go, and who knows what role that the U.S. will have in the Bahrains and the Yemens of the world. I mean, we always said that this will just be no-fly zone enforcement in Libya, and I'm sure it's far more than that. So I think it's just risky politically, and here we go talking about political implications and not real budget concerns, but political implications of cutting the defense and saying you're going to cut the defense while the U.S. is involved in two wars and possibly a third.
Plus, the defense contractors have done a nice job spreading the wealth. There's a defense plant or a defense supplier just about in every congressional district in the country, and it's hard to cut jobs in your own district if you're a member of Congress. 292-8513, if you'd like to join our discussion. Ken Rudin, he is the NPR political editor and also host of the blog The Political Junkie at NPR.org. You can hear him. Are you on Wednesday? Are you on tomorrow with Neil Conan?
Indeed, but you're getting the good stuff one day in advance.
That's right. We're getting a preview of tomorrow's Political Junkie segment on Talk of the Nation at 2 o'clock on 89.7.
You're just getting reruns on Wednesdays.
Well, we have the Ohio slant here, so we'll get to some of the Ohio things in just a moment. So basically, we're down to the last couple of days before a shutdown. At the very least, it looks like we'll probably get a continuing resolution for another week. If you had to put money on the table right now,
I would. And yet, you know, remember what precipitated the shutdown in 1995 is when the Republicans pushed through another 1 week continuing resolution, and Bill Clinton vetoed it, which basically led to the 21-day shutdown, which was the longest in the nation's history. And yet, you know, even though President Clinton vetoed that continuing resolution, it was Newt Gingrich and the Republicans who paid the price, and it was a big issue in Clinton's easy reelection victory in 96.
Okay. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about the presidential election, which is officially underway, thanks to President Obama, who, no surprise, has announced his reelection bid. And we'll look at the Senate race coming up in 2012 here in Ohio, when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News, and join us this afternoon at 2 o'clock for Talk of the Nation. The Supreme Court heard arguments in the largest sex discrimination suit in U.S. history last month. Some say the long battle over sex discrimination at work is over. We'll hear from both sides on Talk of the Nation at 2 on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Wexner Center for the Arts, presenting Juan and John April 7th through the 10th. Solo performer Roger Guenver Smith brings to life the story of two baseball legends' violent encounter at home plate in 1965. More at wexarts.org.
42 degrees in downtown Columbus, some clouds and some sunshine today, a high of 49. Clouds tonight and a little chilly, a low of 35 degrees. Cloudy for Wednesday and a little warmer, a high of 62. All Sides with Ann Fisher with guest host Mike Thompson continues on 89.7 NPR News.
When then-Senator Barack Obama announced he was running for president back in, I believe, 2007, it was a great stagecraft. It was in front of the old Illinois State House, evoking images and thoughts of Abraham Lincoln. Great stagecraft, great political theater. When Barack Obama announced his reelection bid, He used a YouTube video.
Kind of nervous about it. It's like it's coming. Here it is, 2012, the election.
I think it needs to reflect the changes that we've seen in the last 2.5 years. Then we had an underdog senator. You know, nobody thought that he had a chance. And now he's the president.
I just saw the energy.
Ken Rudin, what did you think about the video that the president used to announce that he will seek re-election?
Well, you know something, I didn't see President Obama there.
And I think
that was the most interesting point. We saw key voters, you know, selected voters in key states like North Carolina, Colorado, Nevada, things like that. But basically, the thing President Obama, first of all, there's no question that President Obama is going to raise a ton of money. He raised, I think, $750 million in 2008. We're looking at a $1 billion campaign in 2012. But the thing is, in 2008, there was weariness. There was weariness with President Bush. There was weariness about the war. The Katrina episode was still weighing on people's minds. And there was a real anti-Republican sentiment. We saw that in Ohio 2 years earlier in 2006. And so he had everything in his favor, certainly not in the Republicans' favor. Now the question is, 2012, did the rhetoric and the promise match the record? And President Obama says, yes, things are better than they were. There are still problems, but things are getting better and will continue to get better. And, of course, Republicans, as they made the case in 2010, saying that this is really basically a failed administration and do not deserve 4 more years. And that's what the choice will be in 2012.
You know, of all the people in that video, Ohio, there wasn't anybody from Ohio. Should we be offended?
No, because everybody knows, and I'm not saying this because I'm on your show, Mike, but everybody knows the importance of Ohio. We say this over and over again. Had John Kerry received 60,000 more votes in Ohio in 2004, he would be president. He would have been elected president. Ohio is a key swing state, and we say this over and over again, that no Republican has ever been elected president without winning Ohio. Both sides know how important Ohio is. And again, which Ohio will we see in 2012? Will we see the tired of Republicans in 2008, or are we going to see the Ohio where they were tired of Democrats and Ted Strickland and the government and the budget problems in 2012? And that's what not only President Obama has to weigh, but Senator Sherrod Brown as well.
How much of a factor is it that Ted Strickland is not the governor of Ohio anymore? It's a Republican, John Kasich.
Well, you know something, I think people, a lot of people overrate that. They always say that, well, if you have a governor of your own party, they can help you win the state. And we saw, for example, in Michigan for years, you had John Engler, you had Republican governors for a long, long time, and Democrats were still winning the state. You had Republican governors of Pennsylvania for a long time with Tom Ridge, and yet Democrats were still winning the state presidentially. It's always good to have a governor take you around the state, but of course, you know, if Ted Strickland was still in power and very unpopular, the last thing you want is a presidential candidate resting, you know, on the bad polling numbers of an unpopular governor. And that's where Republicans may have to deal with in 2012 if Kasich's numbers fall because of the budget problems there and his budget decisions.
Yeah, they're already around 30%,
yeah,
the approval ratings. I'm not sure how much further they can fall, but they're pretty low right now, the approval ratings for John Kasich. We're speaking with Ken Rudin, NPR's senior political editor and the host of the blog Political Junkie. You hear him every Wednesday on Talk of the Nation here on 89.7 NPR News. Is it me, or is there a lack of excitement over the potential Republican candidates for president?
Well, you know, it's like what happened to Harry Reid, Senator Harry Reid of Nevada in 2010. Everybody hates him. He's definitely going to lose. You know, they can't wait to get rid of him. And yet nobody could beat him. There was no Republican out there who could beat him. And somebody who was a sure loser won because of the lack of enthusiasm and the lack of qualities in the Republican opposition. And a lot of Republicans are nervous about the fact that, as much as Republicans detest, and detest is not too strong of a word, of President Obama in the last 2-3 years, there are problems, there are serious problems with nearly every Republican who's out there. I mean, we have these dreams about Jeb Bush and Chris Christie, the governor of New Jersey, and the reason we have dreams about these guys is, one, they're not going to run, and two, those who are going to run, like Romney, who has Romney care problems, Haley Barbour, who has racial problems, I mean, all these problems that all these other candidates have, a lot of Republicans are very nervous going against probably a united Democratic Party. I saw a report the other day that now that Kucinich is taking on Obama on Libya, maybe he's planning a 2012 campaign. I don't know, whatever that means. I think the Democratic Party is united. And again, if you don't have a socially conservative, a pure conservative running in 2012, if you have a Mitch Daniels, for example, who, God forbid, sometimes wants to deal and negotiate with Democrats, well, that's, you know, that's not acceptable to many in the party. So, you know, it's going to be a tough battle for Republicans to unseat this guy, this Barack Obama guy, even though they say he's so beatable.
Yeah, when you look at the potential, who do you think is definitely running? Mitt Romney?
Definitely Mitt Romney. Definitely Tim Pawlenty. There's no question about that. Mm-hmm. Rick Santorum, the former senator from Pennsylvania, is running. But, you know, Michelle Bachmann looks like she's doing everything she can to get her name out there. And don't dismiss Michelle Bachmann in a state like Iowa, where evangelical conservatives are very, very strong. Remember, Mike Huckabee won the caucuses there in 2008. Pat Robertson did very well there in 1988 when the Christian rights finally, you know, first became a potent force in politics. We don't know what's going to happen with Mike Huckabee. That he's given mixed signals. He sounds like he's going to candidate, but he keeps saying, well, I don't know if I'm running. I don't know if I'm running. And everybody wants to know with Sarah Palin. I mean, you know, basically what she's doing is she's Twittering and she's Facebooking and she's Foxing on Fox News, but not much else. And you wonder if you could win a nomination that way. And a lot of people, more and more people are thinking you can't do it that way.
Donald Trump, is he a serious candidate or is he just trying to boost his ratings?
I don't think he's serious in the Trump household. I mean, remember a couple of years ago he was pro-choice, he was pro-gay rights, and now he's become a Bertha. He's a member of the John Birth Society. I mean, I don't know what he's doing, but, you know, Donald Trump is, you know, I like to make the joke that he's the heir apparent. but look, I don't think he's serious, and I think that's what's wrong with politics, that we talk about the Donald Trump. You know, there's so many people talking about Donald Trump, and I hate to say it, but your friend Ann is very interested in talking about Donald Trump, but I think it's just nonsensical. He can't win the nomination. He's more of a carnival figure than anything else, and yet I guess maybe because of the dearth of excitement for the Republican field, more and more people are talking about Donald Trump.
No, it would be a fun debate to get some of these folks up on stage, but there's no debate that's been canceled, right? There was one that was planned for not too distant future.
Right, there was one that was sponsored by Fox News and the Republican Party, and they basically were going to it was an NBC Politico debate that was scheduled in Simi Valley, California, with the Reagan Foundation. But because no candidates were coming forward, and basically it was going to be Tim Pawlenty, Herman Cain, and Rick Santorum, so it was postponed to September 14th. So look. You know, a lot of us complain. A lot of us say, oh, these presidential races start so early. In 2007, you know, 4 years ago at this time, there were like 20 candidates already running. And people said, oh, no, enough. You know, give us a moment to breathe from the last election. So now people are complaining, well, it's not starting soon enough. I think if it starts in earnest by Labor Day, which is the way it used to be in the old days, I mean, when you think of, you know, John Kennedy announced his candidacy in January of 1960, the year of the election.
Wow.
I mean, so, you know, in the old days you could do that. And if it happened like this for this time, it wouldn't be the worst thing in the world.
And for all intents and purposes, I mean, somebody like Tim Pawlenty is running. I mean, he's not officially a candidate, but he's got his exploratory committee.
Which is far more than any other Republican except for Herman Cain. No other Republican even has an exploratory committee. Not Newt Gingrich, not Mitt Romney, not Michelle Bachmann. They don't have that at all.
One more question on the presidential election, then we'll move on. I want to ask you to put your branding hat on. And in 2008, it was hope and change. In 2010, you could say, well, it could have been worse. What's 2012's theme for President Obama?
I guess, you know, we're still trying. Avis was we try harder, but but look, you know, Obama could make with convincing argument that he inherited a real big mess in 2008 on the economic front, on the foreign war front, and you know, has he accomplished everything? No. Has he kept his promises? No. Look at Guantanamo, and there are a lot of things that he said he would do that he didn't do. The question is what the opposition is. Again, you have to beat somebody with somebody, and if the Republicans can't get their act together, and I think they will. I mean, we're still talking. This is still April 2011, and we still have a long way to go. But if there's, you know, fratricidal warfare in the GOP, then there's no question in my mind that Obama has a very good shot at winning a second term.
Also seeking re-election in 2012 is U.S. Senator Sherrod Brown. He'll be seeking his second term after being first elected in 2006. He's not an official candidate yet, but all signs point to State Treasurer Josh Mandel, newly elected State Treasurer Josh Mandel, as the likely Republican opponent. And, of course, Josh Mandel made news for a controversial political ad he ran in the last year's campaign.
Voice outsourced Ohio work to a risky Boston bank, but only after they hired his friend as a lobbyist. And the lobbyist? Voice gave his wife a sensitive job in the treasurer's office, a job Voice admitted he only made available at their mosque. The plain dealer calls it insider dealing.
For an honest choice.
The part of that ad talking about Kevin Boyce meeting somebody or offering a job to somebody in a mosque. Josh Mandel took a lot of criticism for basically being accused of implying that Kevin Boyce was a Muslim. He wasn't. Kevin Boyce is not a Muslim, but it was criticized as being Muslim baiting. But criticism aside, can Josh Mandel, of all the Republicans who ran in 2008, he received the most votes. He received more votes than John Kasich did.
Well, yeah, 2010, you mean? Yes,
yes, 2010.
Yeah,
yes.
Exactly. Well, yes, you know, you could criticize Josh Mandel for that ad, and you can criticize, you know, Sherrod Brown when he was talking about Wisconsin. He was saying, well, you know, Hitler didn't like the unions and Stalin didn't like the unions. I mean, you know,
yeah. The
one party doesn't own the rights to awful rhetoric. So both sides go over the top. The thing is, and if you say, well, Josh Mandel was just elected, how can he now run for the Senate? Well, you know, Barack Obama was just elected to the Senate. How can he run for president when he was in the Senate for only 15 minutes? Both sides will make that argument. The thing is, Mandel just seems a little green. I mean, you know, earlier, you know, if this were 2010 and Sherrod Brown were up, I mean, I could see him just going down the way Russ Feingold went down in Wisconsin. He's a liberal. He's cantankerous. He's, you know, he's a scrapper in a conservative year. But, you know, first of all, two things. Sherrod Brown is a great campaigner. I mean, he clobbered Mike DeWine in 2006. He's been like 40 years in politics, and that's not always a plus. But, you know, he wins. And again, he does have, while, you know, you had Obama and Obamacare hurting the Democrats in 2010, maybe you have Kasich and Kasich's decision-making things hurting the Republicans in 2012. I mean, anything could happen if this were another Republican tsunami year like it was in 2010. Sherrod Brown would be in trouble. But, I mean, right now, if Josh Mandel is what the Republicans have, I think Brown survives another term. But, I mean, look, you know, to talk about 2012 here in April of 2011
Yeah. Reminds
me of what we did on the New Hampshire primary in 2008. The day of the primary, we were all convinced that Barack Obama would beat Hillary Clinton in New Hampshire. I mean, we were just sure of it. So if we can't predict the day of the primary what's going to happen, how can we talk about what's going to happen in a year and a half? And I think that's why God gave us voters.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not up to smart alecky, you know, pundits like me, like other people in Washington to make predictions. But ultimately, it's what happens, you know, what the political scene looks like in 2012.
But it is the first indication of how vulnerable a candidate might be. When you look at Ted Strickland, John Kasich was out very early saying he wants to run for governor. And you knew that he was going to be a formidable candidate
and
because
right,
of his track
record.
His
polls were good from the beginning, right?
But there are other Republicans, John Husted, the Secretary of State here in Ohio, Mary Taylor, the Lieutenant Governor. Their names are not being mentioned as often, even though they have much higher name recognition than Josh Mandel. So it might be an indication of Senator Brown's vulnerability at this point.
Well, or lack of same. I agree
yeah.
with you. And also the fact is, you know, like Husted, like Mary Taylor, you know, they also were just elected. And one thing about Mandel is, and I think I've heard a lot of, first of all, he seems to be a true blue conservative,
mm-hmm.
and the conservatives do like that. And he can raise a ton
yes.
of money, and you need a ton of money to be Sherrod Brown in a very expensive state like Ohio.
A lot of senators are saying we've had enough. 8 of 33 senators up for re-election have announced their intention to retire. It seems to be an equal number of Democrats and Republicans.
Well, if you look at the ledger, of the 33 Senate seats that are up in 2012, 23 are held by the Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
So they have a lot more at stake, more to lose. But you're absolutely right. There are 3 of the 10 Republicans are already leaving, and 5 of the 23 Democrats are already leaving. But of course, some of them are in same states where they should do well. They should keep the seats. Like, for example, Daniel Akaka in Hawaii, a state that hasn't elected a Republican to the Senate since 1970, is retiring, and maybe that's good news for the Democrats. just like Joe Lieberman retiring in Connecticut, may be good news for the Democrats. But sometimes when you retire, like, you know, you see in North Dakota with Kent Conrad retiring, that could give an opportunity for the Republicans to win another Senate seat there. So a lot of it is depending on what the situation is in the particular state.
Any commonality among these retirees?
I don't think so. I mean, you have some new folks. You have some, you know, veterans. You have, I mean, but I think it just gets more and more grueling and more, you know, just like Voinovich, I think, you know, in 2010, he just had enough. Kent Conrad, who probably would have been a clear favorite to win re-election in North Dakota, he just had enough. And I think there's a lot of, you know, I've had enough. The fact is we meaning Washington, can't seem to do a budget for more than a week at a time without everybody screaming at each other. We can't seem to get anything done in the Senate because you need 60 votes now, or maybe, you know, which is unheard of years ago when once upon a time you needed a majority. It's just not working. It's just that the amount of money is just unbelievable. The amount of negative attacks from both sides is just, you know, unbelievable. And everybody's fighting not only the last war, but the next war. So, you know, as soon as you're elected, you have to raise money, and it just gets tiresome. It's not the Senate I knew when I was growing up, when Democrats and Republicans actually had the temerity to talk to each other. They can't do that anymore. Otherwise, they'll be hit by a primary by the other side.
We're speaking with Ken Rudin, the political junkie from NPR, NPR's senior political editor, here on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson, sitting in for Ann today on 89.7 NPR News. Tea Party influence on these races, Ken. Richard Lugar of Indiana may face an opponent. Olympia Snowe from Maine may face an opponent from the right. Is that weighing on these senators as well?
They have to. I mean, first of all, Dick Lugar, first elected in 1976. If you looked in a dictionary for the words Indiana Republican, you would see Dick Lugar's face. I mean, he was Mr. Republican for the longest time, but he's been very cozy in the minds of some Tea Party folks, very cozy with the Democrats and Obama. And Richard Murdoch, who's the state treasurer, has already announced he will run. And just like we saw with Robert Bennett in Utah, you know, this is a very serious challenge, and Dick Lugar, for all he's done for Republicans in Indiana for all these decades, he could very well lose. And same with Olympia. I mean, Olympia Snowe, look, is a moderate and sometimes a liberal. Dick Lugar, in my estimation, has always been a conservative, even although slightly independent, but a conservative. Just like Orrin Hatch in Utah, he's scared to death of a Tea Party challenge. Orrin Hatch. I mean, this guy, you know, when he was first elected in 76, too, he was probably the most conservative guy in the Senate. But as the Republican Party has moved further and further to the right, and I think the Democratic Party has moved to the left as well, but the Republican Party so far to the right that, you know, some of these Republicans don't even recognize their party anymore.
We're speaking with Ken Rudin, NPR's political junkie, on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. When we come back, we'll take a look at the big union ballot issue coming up in Ohio and how that's going to play around the country. And we'll look at the possible future employment prospects of Ted Strickland when we return on All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, the smallpox epidemic at the turn of the 20th century and the civil liberties questions raised by how the government enforced mandatory vaccinations.
There were scenes of policemen holding down men in their nightrobes, and inspectors were going room to room looking for children with smallpox.
We'll talk with Michael Woolrich, author of Pox.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon here on 89.7 NPR News. In 1862, President Lincoln signed the Homestead Act and created a world of opportunity for thousands of families that poured onto the prairies. Tonight on WOSU-TV, Homesteading blends interviews with historians and the stories told by descendants of these pioneers. The families came for many reasons: a hunger for land, a vision for the future, or a longing for adventure. Watch Homesteading. It's tonight at 10:30 on WOSU-TV.
Support for 89.7 comes from Horizon Science and Noble Academies, providing college prep curriculum focusing on science and math. Information about Horizon and Noble Academies college acceptance rates is at horizoncolumbus.org.
And it's 43 degrees in downtown Columbus. Some sunshine and a few clouds today, a high near 49. Clouds tonight, a low of 35 degrees. And clouds tomorrow, a little warmer with a high of 62. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. Our guest, Ken Rudin, the NPR senior political editor and the political junkie. You hear him each and every Wednesday on Talk of the Nation with Neil Conan. An email from Tom, Ken. He wants me to ask you to make a few very terrible puns so Tom knows it's really you. On a serious note, he says, until we get campaign finance reform, getting elected will always be the name of the game instead of serving the American people.
Well, that goes with that question, and there's nothing funny or punny about that. I mean, it's exactly true, and that's why you have somebody like a Paul Ryan who's going to say, well, look, you know, my game is not getting elected. It's doing the right thing, in his view, or the party's view, the right thing for the American people. And, of course, more and more members of Congress and politicians don't do that or are afraid to do that because if their goal is to get reelected, then doing unpopular things like cutting entitlement programs is not the way to do it. So one, you know, you could be popular and nothing gets accomplished, or you can take on some behemoths like Medicare and Medicaid and then see where the chips fall.
I know you're a sports fan, Ken. I don't know if you watched the basketball game last night, but
you missed two
great puns at the end. Jim Nance, after UConn won, said UConn is the top dog in college basketball. And then he said, which caused me to turn the TV off, UConn is best in show in NCAA basketball.
First of all, I'm saying why we keep talking about UConn? I mean, why don't we talk about Manitoba? I mean, who cares about these provinces? They're foreigners up in Canada. The thing is, this was a deadly game. I mean, I was rooting for Butler and I was also rooting before that. I was rooting for Virginia Commonwealth because you love upsets, but you also love a good basketball game. And this was, I mean, they just couldn't make baskets at all. And I mean, I thought the Muhammad Ali Sonny Liston rematch was more well played than this game. It was just awful.
The dogs, of course, because both teams were dogs. Butler was the Bulldogs, and UConn is the Huskies.
Husky,
okay,
right.
Enough basketball. Let's go to the phones. Matt, you're on the air with NPR political junkie Ken Rudin.
Yeah, I like his long term view about what's going to happen when the Tea Party agenda starts being manifest a little more broadly in the legislative agenda. I mean, in Ohio, there was talk about jobs before the election, and after the election, we've had guns and bars, abortion, and bargaining rights. Mm-hmm. So the Tea Partiers may be able to knock out Republicans in primaries, but I'm wondering how wide the appeal is going to be when they've got a real legislative history to campaign on.
Well, that's a good point. I mean, that was basically what was the difference between Newt Gingrich as a bomb-throwing outsider pre-1994 and then as Speaker of the House after 1994. You know, from the outside, it's easy to criticize, it's easy to throw at bombs and easy to rally your troops. But then when you have to make tough decisions, you alienate a big part of your constituency. Now, the thing with the Tea Party is for the longest time, they were not talking about social issues like abortion, like same-sex marriage, things like that. They were just talking about budgetary concerns and spending, you know, government spending. And if they're going to just move that mandate, which they say they got in 2010, if they're going to move it to social issues as well, well, that's not going to create the jobs that Republicans insist that they want to create. So it could be very damaging. And you're right. I mean, look, they did – the Tea Party is what made John Boehner Speaker of the House, and they did knock off so many Democrats, that many of whom I never thought were going to lose. But at the same time, if now they're focusing on those so-called rhinos, those Republicans in name only who are not sufficiently conservative, if you take them out, if you take the Olympia Snows of the world out, well, then that opens up a Senate seat for a Democrat to win. So besides very strong rhetoric, besides people losing their jobs, besides tremendous, you know, loss of collective bargaining and pensions and things like that, if you're going to just, you know, eat your own, as some Tea Party Republicans are planning to do, then it could only help the Democrats in 2012.
Ken Rudin is the NPR political junkie, NPR's senior political editor. He joins us here on All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. The collective bargaining fight in Ohio is really just beginning. The governor signed the bill into law last week. It severely limits the rights of public employee unions to bargain, prohibits them from striking, eliminates binding arbitration. Those are the details of the bill. But now it's being looked at, because it likely will be on the ballot in November, as a national referendum on unions. And there'll be the speculation is there'll be a lot of national money coming into Ohio, a lot of national attention paid to this state over this issue.
Oh, there's no question about that. Just like there's tremendous amount of money coming into Wisconsin today for that Supreme Court seat.
Mm-hmm.
David Prosser, who's, even though it's a nonpartisan race, David Prosser, the incumbent, if he's reelected, then it's seen as an affirmation about what Scott Walker is doing with the budget, with the unions there. And if he's defeated, then, well, maybe the unions come back and maybe they give them a second life. You know, for the longest time, we were talking about the irrelevancy, the political irrelevancy of labor unions. But, you know, who knows if the Kasich moves, if the Scott Walker moves, if those kind of things, Rick Scott in Florida, if they're seen as extreme, then perhaps the Democrats could come back. Look, you know, a lot of it could be very personal. We always talked about, well, maybe George Bush went to war because to avenge his father, or all these, you know, crazy theories. But look, the police and firefighters, those the unions, the state unions, public employee unions, spent a fortune to reelect Strickland
mm-hmm.
last year. So maybe Kasich is just getting back at them. Who knows what's happening? But the point is, this shows the true philosophical differences between the two parties and over the strength and the role of what labor is all about. And just like Wisconsin is going to send a big message today's election, Ohio, the referendum in Ohio on, you know, repealing SB 5 or not repealing it or whatever, it will be a national issue with tons and tons of money thrown in.
Does it have any implications for 2012? I mean, the Republicans really, here in Ohio, really rushed to get this on the ballot in 2011. So for a couple of reasons, they didn't want it on the ballot in 2012, and partly because all the House members here in Ohio, the state House members, would be running for re-election in 2012, and they didn't want it on the ballot in 2012 during a presidential race. But I've always thought that the unions organize better, that helps win elections in off years. What implications might this have in the presidential race in 2012?
Well, you know something, I mean, there are only a handful of states that people are really, really watching closely in 2012, and those are basically the states that Obama won in 2008, that John Kerry didn't win in 2004, the Ohios, the Floridas, the North Carolinas, the Virginias, the Colorados of the world. I mean, that's really, unfortunately, we like to think of it as a national election, but mm-hmm. really there's only about anywhere between 6 and 12 states that people are paying attention to. So in states like Ohio, if there is a pushback against, you know, Kasich's budget philosophy, if there's a pushback in Wisconsin against Scott Walker, again, if the Republicans are repudiated in 2011, then that obviously gives a lot of momentum for the Democrats in 2012. But, you know, think of 1991. President Bush, George H.W. Bush, the first Bush, was so popular.
Mm-hmm.
His numbers were so high. Some Democrats were saying, look, let's just endorse him, get it over with, and just forget about 92. So things can turn, you know, on a dime. And we don't know what's going to happen in Libya. We don't know if the whole world is going to fall apart. It's not doing so well as it is. And who knows how bad it's going to get. And who knows, you know, right now we're talking about 8.8% unemployment. If that goes down, that's good news. If it goes up, it's not. So there are, you know, distractions like, I'm not saying what Ohio and Wisconsin are doing are not important. I don't mean to belittle it as a mm-hmm. distraction. But ultimately, there could be one overriding theme that could determine the entire election.
And if the Republicans do win the fight over collecting and bargaining in Ohio, it could give them momentum heading into 2012.
Absolutely. I mean, there could be you could see a lot of discouraged Democrats. And you could see, you know, one of the best things that Democrats ever had going for them was the power and the purse of the labor unions. And again, if that's curtailed, if the mandatory contributions to labor unions are stopped, you know, the role of labor, which has been diminishing and more recently, could be even more diminished in 2012.
So the Republicans could take a short-term hit, but long-term benefit if they ultimately prevail in this.
And who knows? I mean, what if they recall the Republicans in Wisconsin, or what if they recall the Democrats in Wisconsin? A lot, you know, these are small little battles. You know, I guess World War I didn't start on a global scale. It was the assassination of the Archduke, in Serbia. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that we were equating the assassination of the Archduke of Serbia to John Kasich and Scott Walker in the Midwest. But, you know, these things could prove to be the theme, the overriding theme for the presidential election.
Moving on, Ted Strickland has been named as a possible head of the Democratic National Committee. Let's listen to what Ted Strickland had to say about that.
And anything that I could do to try to make sure that Barack Obama is reelected and that Senator Sherrod Brown is reelected and that the Democrats recapture the Ohio House of Representatives, I want to be a part of.
Ted Strickland, recently a defeated governor of Ohio, not saying he's a candidate, but certainly not throwing cold water on the idea that he would replace Tim Kaine as the chairman of the DNC. Would Ted Strickland be a good chairman, politically speaking, for the Democrats?
I think he would be a great choice. As a matter of fact, you know, I am always kind of hesitant about predictions because I'm always so wrong. But Ted Strickland is my prediction for the DNC chair to replace Tim Kaine. And as we said earlier in the show, it just shows the importance and what's at stake in Ohio, not just for President Obama, but, you know, you have the Republicans need only three Senate seats or four Senate seats, depending on who wins the presidency, to win control of the Senate. Sherrod Brown's reelection is so crucial for the Democratic Party. And as they say, you know, the Democrats lost five House seats in 2010. They lost the State House. It did sound like from that bite that Ted Strickland was running for Democratic chairman of Ohio, but I think that Strickland and Obama are very close. And it's interesting, you know, there are a lot of Democrats around the country who are clearly have made it clear that they're going to run away from President Obama in 2012. We see some indications from Claire McCaskill of Missouri and John Tester in Montana, another senator who said, well, you know, I think I'll run independently. But Ted Strickland is close with Obama. Sherrod Brown is not backing down at all. And so it makes sense to have a trusted ally as Democratic National Chairman, and I think it will be Ted Strickland.
Ted Strickland faced some criticism, even among Democrats, that he wasn't fiery enough during this campaign. He criticized John Kasich for his Wall Street ties over and over again, but he wasn't fiery enough when it came to defending Democratic principles or his record as governor and what he had done for the state. Would that criticism hold true, and is there any validity to it? And might it hurt him as the head of the National Party?
Well, I think if there was a Republican president, then Ted Strickland would not make a good DNC chair, because you need a Howard Dean screaming and yelling and pointing out the mistakes. Strickland, I think, is not something that he's too much of a gentleman, but I don't think it's in his makeup. I remember him when he was in the House here in Washington. He was just not that kind of yeller and screamer. But look, the titular head of the Democratic Party is not going to be the DNC chair. It's going to be President Obama.
Yeah.
And I think that for that reason, I think Strickland would be the right choice and will be the choice.
The other name that's been mentioned is Debbie Wasserman Schultz, Florida congresswoman, good at fundraising, from Florida, another key state.
She is more fiery, that's true. But I kind of think that, look, you want a full-time chairman, and, of course, Debbie Wasserman Schultz is not about to give up her House seat. That's why I think it's Strickland.
You wrote in your blog about Geraldine Ferraro, who passed away last week, and the pioneering run for vice president she made in 1984. What are your memories of her and what she added to the American political culture?
Well, you know, I was, you know, like a lot of us, I was there in San Francisco. Of course, Mondale announced her several days before the convention in St. Paul, Minnesota. But when she stood up there, I mean, I still remember all the tears. It was just, it doesn't sound like it's a big deal, but, you know, after, you know, all these years, no woman has ever made it to a major party ticket. Now, of course, there were members of the minor parties who were presidential nominees and vice presidential nominees, but with the big boys, the Democrats and the Republicans, it was always male only, and Ferraro's choice was historic. Was it the right choice? Well, one, I've never been somebody who says that the VP decides an election. I mean, for all the ridicule that Dan Quayle got in 1988, Bush Quayle still won 40 out of 50 states. So, you know, but it was a symbolic yes. Was Walter Mondale under pressure to pick a female running mate? Yes. Did it help? Well, they lost 49 states out of 50. So I don't know. Maybe nothing could have saved Walter Mondale against Ronald Reagan. But in that in their 15 minutes of fame, it was just an amazing moment in politics. You know, a lot of people say, well, it doesn't really matter the color of your skin, the gender, but we still talk about Jackie Robinson. We still talk about Larry Doby. We still talk about the first Catholic, the first Jew, the first Muslim, the first woman. And I think it is historic. But ultimately, when you think of her career, she'll always be remembered as this trailblazing figure. But the rest of it, you know, she ran for the Senate twice after that. She lost. She was embarrassed by comments she made about Barack Obama's race in 2008, saying that the only reason he's doing so well is that, you know, if he were white, he wouldn't be doing that so well. And that's kind of unfortunate for her to say that, especially because if she were a man, Geraldine Ferraro never would have been picked by Walter Mondale. But so all in all, it's a mixed record. But again, that moment in San Francisco was just one I'll never forget.
Were you surprised it took so long? She was, you know, nominated for vice president in 1984, and it really wasn't until Hillary Clinton and, I mean, Elizabeth Dole ran for president, but Hillary Clinton and Sarah Palin in 2008 that there was another, you know, woman on the ticket or serious challenger for the presidency.
Well, you know, it's look, we still talk about this over and over again. Women are 51% of the population, and I think there's 17% of Congress. That's still maybe women still have trouble with fundraising. We saw that in your own Senate race last year with Jennifer Brunner. Mm-hmm. I mean, basically, you know, I thought she would have been a stronger candidate, but she clearly wasn't the establishment choice. She clearly wasn't raising as much money as her opponent, so that's still a problem. But, you know, I mean, there was like Pat Schroeder had a mini bid for the presidency, you know, in 87 that didn't go anywhere. And basically Elizabeth Dole didn't go anywhere either. But until 2008, with Hillary Clinton came within a whisker of getting the Democratic nomination, Sarah Palin on the ticket, which nobody ever expected. You know, one day we'll laugh at these things saying, well, you know, who cares? I mean, who cares what the gender is? But there are still... You know, the fact is, in 2008, you know, the fact that Hillary Clinton could still campaign for the presidency and somebody will yell out, wash, you know, iron my shirt, and people will laugh. I mean, you know, it's like, you know, nobody laughs at a racial thing that's yelled out in the crowd. The fact that they still laugh at sexist things like that shows that we still have a long way to go.
Speaking with Ken Rudin, NPR's political junkie, senior political editor at NPR. Just a couple of minutes left here on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. Quickly on foreign policy, what do you think are the long-term effects of the president's Libya policy, what's going on with Guantanamo and the decision to hold military trials for the 9/11 plotters?
Well, tell me what the policy is. I mean, the thing is, the policy once was Guantanamo gets shut down within a year. That didn't happen. The policy once was we try, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in a civilian court. That didn't happen. They changed their mind on that. The policy in Libya once was, oh, no, there's no way we get involved. And then it was, okay, maybe a no-fly zone. And now what are we doing? I mean, what's our goal? What's our end game? They say it's not the overthrow of Gaddafi, but what happens if the rebels are routed?
I mean,
what does the policy change? It just seems like there's no consistency. And I understand it's a changing world, and you just can't. George W. Bush was always criticized for being very consistent and never changing his mind. But, you know, why, if we go into Libya, why not Bahrain? Why not Yemen? I mean, Yemen, Al-Qaeda has a foothold in Yemen. Why isn't that a bigger issue? So it just seems like it's haphazard, and I'm sure it isn't. But there doesn't seem to be a signal sent by the White House that it just seems like it's reacting more than planning in advance. And again, I don't know how you plan in advance with things changing so rapidly.
Okay. My thanks to Ken Rudin, the political junkie, NPR's political editor here on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Thanks, Ken.
Thank you, Mike.
We'll listen to you tomorrow on Talk of the Nation on WOSU. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7, WOSU HD1, and WOSU H1D Columbus, and streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News is a service of WOSU Public Media.